Okay, so we're returning to an area that I've done before, and basically I'm not really changing anything in terms of the basic explanations that I gave, but there's a new dimension which I uncovered just recently, and I want to go into it. It's in Perek. Well, the thing is like this. Really, the shiur concerns two sources. This story is unusual because in most cases of the Torah, the narrative, so to speak, when the Torah describes events, so we have to, the information that conveyed to us is conveyed in the telling of the story. But the Torah uses two different types of method in conveying a story. Sometimes, and this, by the way, I mean, of course, l'havdil, but you'll find this in literature in general, or even in cinema, whatever it may be. You could tell a story in two ways. You could describe it as it's happening, or very often, like as I said, l'havdil, but sometimes a movie will start at the end, and the person is recounting events. You understand? Okay. Now, the Torah communicates by direct narrative, and also we learn things not by direct narrative, but by people recounting what took place. Okay, now a case in point is the story in Membez, chapter Membez in Bereishis, when the brothers come down to Egypt because of the famine, in order to get food. I'm not to give you all the background. You know the basic story. Okay, now let's take a look at what happens. What happens is, you're all familiar with the fact that Yosef was the ruler. He was in charge of all the distributions of food, and he was situated in a place, I guess, by the border, when people entered the customs, when they entered into the country. Okay, we're not going to go into why that makes perfect sense, because that was his main function. And in point of fact, that was his main function, and being appointed as the most powerful individual was because of this issue. So he was given complete charge over in the seven good years in the preservation of the food, and then in the seven lean years in the distribution, which is a very, very complicated thing. It's not simple. And the you have to really be a genius to figure out how to do it without bringing your own country into poverty, and also with trying to be fair, trying to give out the right amount and set up the prices and so on and so forth. There's many, many issues. So Yosef was in charge. Okay, so then you know that Yosef saw his... Take a look at Zion. Yosef saw his brothers, and he recognized them. And Vayisnaker aleihem. What does that mean? Vayidabri tam kashos. He spoke very harshly with them. Vayomar aleihem ayin basam. And he said to them, from whence do you come? Vayomru, and they said, from the land of Canaan, in order to acquire food. Of course, right here you can ask a question. But you got the question, Moshe, Stel. Where do you see the kashos? But Yisnaker aleihem, he is strange, he acted strange, like a stranger to them. Okay, that's one thing. Even that is a little bit... Okay, I guess you have to say, the pasuk is trying to tell you that he did not... acting the way you would expect. He didn't reveal who he was. Okay. I think it's more than that, though. It's more that it's not simply conveying the fact that he chose not to reveal who he was. That's one idea. Right? It's not there as a positive thing. You know what I mean? Like, you really assume the role of a stranger. I mean, there's a difference. For example, you act cold to someone. Let's say you go to a party or something. So sometimes the person, is not that friendly. Not excessively friendly, just polite. Just polite, this, that, but polite. Then you say, no, like, the person was cold to me. You can tell. They went out of their way, it's different. It's different. It's one thing when a person is just, doesn't have time or whatever, chooses to spend time with someone else, and just says, oh, how you doing, this and that, and moves on. That's not by Yisnaker. By Yisnaker is more than that. Yeah, but where's the kashos? says he spoke harshly with them, and then it tells you what he said. From where do you come? What's such kashrus about? What's so difficult about that? What's so harsh about that? Okay. So CD is saying it's the tongue. Okay. But that may be true, or it may be that he said certain things which are not being recorded. All that may be true. My question is based upon the simple pasuk. If you follow the simple pasuk, it doesn't seem to indicate any kashrus. But what's the point? What's the point of, like, if he didn't say anything, it makes it a little bit difficult. So just the way he said it, who cares? I mean, like, why is that important? What's the importance of that? Ask the questions like this. The reason why they said Lishbar Ochel would indicate, it's not a bad point. Would fit in with kashos. Would fit in with kashos. Because it wasn't just I am Buslam, it was an accusatory type of thing. Already in the question, even it wasn't just a question of where are you from. So you could ask that in a friendly kind of way, or you could ask it in an accusatory kind of a way. In other words, like,
where are you from?
For example, if you go into like one of these towns, you know, where they're still very careful, like in, say, in New Hampshire somewhere, where they're very machbid, law and order, this and that. They don't put up with nonsense and the strangers. So you can come into a place, and be called over by a policeman for whatever reason, and it could be very friendly. Where are you from? Right? So then you'll answer, you're just curious. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from New York. Or you could sense a certain hostility. Like, where are you from? Meaning, what are you doing here? It's like, it's from the question itself, it's clear that you're a stranger. Where are you from means you're a stranger. What are you doing here? Why are you here? Then a person would just not say where he's from, but he understands the implication, and he would say what he's there for. I'm on business. In other words, that would be the response to someone like, we don't really want you here. The question is, but the basic question is, what's the point of all this kashrus?
No.
It says that Yosef recognized his brothers and they didn't recognize him. Alright, so we all know the explanation of Rashi. Alright, there's no need to explain why that was the case. That's just a matter of circumstances. That, you know, his appearance was completely changed. Bear in mind, this is 22 years after the fact. And they apparently were mature. They had their mature look, their adult look, and that didn't change much. So he recognized them and they didn't recognize him. He looked totally differently. Then you have to ask, well, Yosef remembers the dreams that he dreamt concerning them. And he said to them, he accused them of being spies. You've come to see the weakness, the vulnerability of the land. Okay, I'm not going to go into the answer, but you know the real question over here is, what's the connection between the remembrance of the dreams and the accusation? Okay. We've discussed that before. I want to get a sense of the dialogue. He engages in a dialogue with them now. And on a certain level, it seems to be like ordinary people are just arguing up and back. Like, you know, it's not like no one's listening to anybody over here. And they says, no, my master, your servants have come to, they repeat the point. That's our story. We've come down for food. We're all the sons of one man. We are Canaan. Canaan means we're honest people. Your servants lo hayu. Your servants were never spies. We're not spies to begin with. I mean, I'm not going to go into all the points again, but they're explaining that this is the furthest thing from reality. We're brothers. Like, I guess that was part of the issue. Like, what are all you guys doing together? Chazal said they came in separate places and they joined together. The Torah doesn't have to record every detail, but like, he's questioning your behavior, every aspect of your behavior, and they're explaining it. It's a simple explanation. We're all one family, and spies. You can have a sense for their, for the situation that they're in. Like, when you're being accused, when you're being falsely accused, and it's so far removed from reality. It's like, well, how could you be accused of being a spy? I'd be driving and I'd be stopped by a cop, and all of a sudden, like, alright, he wants to, let's assume I didn't have my license on me because I forgot to take my wallet, which wouldn't you know, which wouldn't be very hard to imagine, and this and that. Then suddenly he's going through my glove compartment, this and that, and before you know it, he's got me up against the car, and he's searching me, and he's accusing me of drugs. I'm a drug dealer. And, you know, like, to my reaction, what are you talking about? I mean, I'm a rabbi, I'm a teacher. I'm drugs, I don't know if I'm drug dealer. I don't know what you're talking about. I know, just the opposite. I've helped people to get off off these things, counseling you. What are you talking about? But look at the dialogue, Yud Beis. By Yom Ralem, he said to them, no. He doesn't refute anything. He's just like, no. You've come to see vulnerability. He just repeats himself. One of my questions that I'm asking now, and this is part of the new material, is what is the need to record all of this dialogue for? What do we get out of all of this dialogue? The Torah doesn't waste any words. The main point that the Torah wants to convey to us is the fact that Yosef put, that's what we have to know, that essentially Yosef decided, he remembered the dreams, and he decided to put a certain plan into action in order to bring about a certain result. And the main focus is that he kept one of the brothers hostage and told them that they could not get any more food unless they would bring back the younger brother. That was his goal. So basically all we need to know is the accusation and the fact that he kept behind one brother as a hostage in order to ascertain, to verify that what Binyan and the condition that they could not receive any further food, they would not be exonerated unless they brought back their younger brother. That's all you need to know. And that could have been conveyed to us. You know, the Torah is very, very concise. Very, very concise. So it could have been conveyed to us in a pasuk or two. I mean, that's it. But why do you have all this doctrine back? They say this, we say that. I mean, why do you have to know all that? It seems to be like, again, in Yud Beis, he doesn't add anything new. He just says, no. He doesn't explain why. And then in Yud Gimel, they go further. They give more information. They try to explain their way out of the situation, that we were really 12 and we're brothers, the sons of one man. And then it's not exactly clear why they have to offer all this information, but they do. And the younger one is with our father, and one of them is gone. And then in Yudah, it's also strange. So Yosef says, "Who Asher Dibarti Aleichem?" Lamar, no. This is what he just repeats himself. This is already the third time he simply made the accusation. And he hasn't given any. He hasn't responded to what they're saying in any way, shape, or form. I mean, if he would say, "Have a question," and then how come your younger brother's not here, or this, what happened to the other one, or something which would break down their story. Father, he doesn't break down their story, he just goes back to what he's saying. You're liars. He doesn't listen. And then he says, then from Tes Vav and on, Bezos Tibachenu, okay, then he says that this is the test. He sets up a condition to bring down the younger brother. And then he says, send back, he has two plans, he changed his plan. He says, send back one, and take your brothers, and you, and he locks them up. The original plan is a very, very harsh plan. He decides to lock them all up in jail, because you're all suspected now, spies. That's very serious, to be a suspected spy. And we'll test out your words, whether they are true. And if they're not true, if your words don't hold, in other words, if it turns out that you lied to me on this, then you're spies. My conclusion is that you're spies. And Yosef puts them in jail for 3 days. Alright? And Yosef said to them on the third day, he changed his plan. He sort of moderates his plan. And he says that he fears God. If you are true people, then should they then leave behind one brother in jail, and the rest of you go and bring back food for the family. He suddenly takes on a more sympathetic tone, although the basic harshness remains. It's just that he's worked out a way that make it a little bit easier for them. And that is, there's no need for everybody to be locked up. So, and your families are starving, you need food. So what I'll do is, I'll make a concession, I'll allow you to bring back food, but I'll keep one brother behind, and if this is what you shall do and live. Below says, he says, bring down your younger brother and your words will be tested and you won't die. What does it mean you won't die? Of course you won't die.
You won't die.
No. If you don't come back, so then he can't kill them. I mean, he's not going to chase after them. It seems a little bit funny. He's saying, yeah, bring back your brother and we'll verify your words and you won't die. In other words, as opposed to if you fail to go along with this, apparently then you will die. There's a little bit of a difficulty, just technically speaking, but if they don't go along with it, then they want, the only one that would die if he was going to kill would be Shimon, who was behind him. Well, the answer is, it means you won't die in the famine. Because he's saying, I'm going to give you supplies, and the point is that you will not die in famine. Because what he's telling them basically is, you got no choice. What I'm giving you is not going to be enough to get you through the famine. Alright, take a look at Pasuk Chaf Aleph and Chaf Beis. That's the key. The Yeshia really focuses on that. Let me focus for the time being on Chaf Aleph. Okay? I think both Pesukim are difficult. But Chaf Aleph is extremely difficult. Extremely, extremely difficult. What is difficult about Chaf Aleph? To me, this is very problematical. What does one thing have to do with the other? Not only does what does one thing have to do with the other, we really are supposed to study Chumash and try and get a philosophy of life from Chumash. And so whenever we can decipher a certain principle, a certain of our philosophy, then we're supposed to live by it. The truth is, are you supposed to live by this methodology? If you go back to the original story, I mean, it seems pretty clear that the brothers did not act out of a wild, you know, out of wild emotional rage. They were great men. We assume that these were shift deker. They were very great men. And therefore, they deliberated. They had a whole cheshbon. They had a whole cheshbon about the character of Yosef. And it was a huge misunderstanding. I've given many shirim on that, how it came about, all the various factors, but the way Yosef behaved in a way which was very, very harmful to himself, and in spite of everything, Yaakov played a role, the favoritism, all the factors that were there. But it led to a deliberation, a fateful event, when Yosef was out there with the brothers, and they had a din Torah, so to speak. They deliberated, and they came to the conclusion. You see that there was deliberation. They even changed the plan. Reuven offered a different possibility, then Yehuda offered another possibility. My point is like this. We have to assume certain things. They were great men. They deliberated. They reached a conclusion. The Pasuk says, Vayeshu lecho lechem, they sat down to eat bread. That indicates that they were not in a frenzied kind of a state, that they were calm. They knew what they were doing. But they made a mistake. The fact of the matter is, even great people that deliberate and come to certain big conclusions, they can be wrong. But the fact that they're wrong doesn't mean that they were shy. We still respect them. Now it seems that even after, it's very strange of it, because it seems that even after they did it, because sometimes a person will have regrets after he did something, it didn't seem that they had any regrets. It does, that they didn't realize the extent of the suffering they would cause Yaakov, because it says they tried to comfort him, and then he refused to be comforted, and he said he'll go down to the grave mourning, so apparently that was painful to them. And Chazal indicates that point. It's not never stated openly that the fact that Yaakov was so upset by this, was so crushed by it, that even that didn't bring them to Tshuva. Did not bring them to Tshuva. Our Rashi says, "Vayered Yehuda, Vayezechav." That the Torah introduces the story of Yehuda, so it was a lashon of Yehuda that it caused a split. That they no longer had the same respect for Yehuda because they saw the suffering of their father. That's fine. It's a marriage, but it still doesn't say that they're Tshuva. How do you know they didn't do tshuva? We'll argue that that's really tshuva, and the brothers did tshuva, and so forth. I would say that you cannot say that the brothers ever they may have had certain emotional feelings and certain attitudes of regret, but I maintain that you must assume that they did not do tshuva. And the proofs are that if they had done tshuva, then they would have immediately gone down to Mitzrayim and searched for Yosef. They would have initiated a search immediately to bring him back, because two would have meant they would have recognized that they had no right to do what they did. And you have to assume that they try. In fact, Chazal say that when they entered Egypt, they entered at different places because they were looking, part of their objective was to find him. So therefore, No. But that wasn't...
Why did they go before that? Why did they go without Phantom?
That wasn't the case. That wasn't, this is 22 years later. 22 years later, whatever damage they inflicted upon them in their minds was done. So whatever the reason they were going to find them, it was a curiosity or whatever, but it wasn't to undo. You can't say that when they came, because they didn't come down to look for him, they came down for food. So while they're there, they would look for him as well, but that's not tshuva. Moreover, as you point, as Avi points out, Aval Hashem Anachnu. Seems to be that now is the first time that they're willing to recognize that they were wrong. Now, what's problematical about this?
Amo Shuk is making a very good point.
That is to say that you must assume that they had not done tshuva, because, as we said, Yosef needed a matir to inflict all the suffering on the brothers in order to get them to do tshuva. And then David Raichet explained that's by Yisgros HaChalomos. It was the remembering of the dreams, and the dreams, the way he interpreted, was a dispensation from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be the so to speak, in Rabbi Chait's words, the Mashgiach Ruchani, that it was his task to bring them back to tshuva and to use whatever means was necessary. So, and then he unleashed the plan. That's how he explained the juxtaposition. That therefore is an excellent proof from Moshe Shuk that at that point in time they had not done tshuva. For had they already done tshuva, what was the point?
Oh, yeah.
Benji asks, how did Yosef know they had not done tshuva at this point in time? I would say tentatively that I think my answer, what I suggested, that as a proof of the fact that they had not done tshuva, that if they had done tshuva, then they would have engaged in some type of a search to try and correct. Because in tshuva, especially in a chet of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, let's go to the halacha. There's a difference between a chet which is bein adam l'makom and bein adam l'chavero. I'm not going to say which one is worse now. But with regard to tshuva, a person has to be careful. Always anticipate the consequences. That's the theme of that essay, the morning after. And also anticipate the difficulty in tshuva. Of course, a person shouldn't say, I'm going to sin and then do tshuva, but at a certain level of the mind, that should be apparent. There's certain types of sins which are very difficult from the standpoint of tshuva. Now, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, it seems to me, is harder. It's harder to do tshuva. It's easier to do tshuva on a Bein Adam L'Makom. Much easier for the person, psychologically. In general. I'm talking general because there it's just between you and God. And psychologically, you don't have to deal with other people. So even though it's more frightening, it's more, on one level it's worse, because it's more frightening. How could you sin against the king? If you had any type of an awareness of the situation, of the reality of the situation, you wouldn't be able to do it, and you'd be horrified to even speak to the king. Yeah, but since psychologically we don't have that type of an attitude towards, we're not on that level to be so ashamed before God, to be so brazen. And it's just the opposite, that to humble ourselves before another person is what we find to be difficult. So, bearing that in mind, given the fact that we're imperfected, realize that in Bein Adam L'Chaveiro there's a tremendous obstacle there, and that is that you have to pacify the other person to actually get his mechila. It's very, very tough. Because it's not just compensation. You can't do compensation. For example, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, were they to want to do tshuva, it would not be sufficient for them to say, well, we've made compensation. It's not enough. Even if they were to do a complete restoration, which they haven't done, with the Swiss monies and so on, you'll never know how much they stole, and I don't think they'll ever pay back. But for our purposes, we're talking in, as the Gemara says, Lu Yitzuya, let us imagine. Let us imagine that they were to make full monetary compensation. And then some, with interest. And then we're to go before the world and say, we've now fully compensated, we've fully redressed this evil. And we've done tshuva gemura, so to speak. So what would we say to them? From a technical standpoint, well, the 6 million are dead, you can't compensate them. Let's assume that were not the issue, okay? Let's assume that somehow or other, you know, the payment would count towards compensating them. I mean, again, you have to do, to make my point, you've got to go along with me on this.
Tshuva,
whatever. The answer is, you haven't done tshuva. You haven't done tshuva. You haven't done tshuva until we forgive you. We have to mechil you. Mechila. Because there's a Bein Adam l'chaveiro. In Bein Adam l'chaveiro, it's not enough. You can't even begin to do tshuva before HaKadosh Baruch Hu until you've redressed the grievance. And in redressing the grievance, for example, if you harm the person, so of course you have to make compensation, but even if you make compensation, it's insufficient. For example, if you cause the person a monetary loss, intentionally, I mean, I'm not talking about accidentally. Yeah, well, let's leave aside the accidental. Let's assume intentionally. You cheated a person. You harmed them. Or in a business, you acted unfairly, whatever, and you know, really, it wasn't the way the understanding the agreement was, and you wound up harming them economically, whatever. So then you feel guilty, and you want to do tshuva, so you figure out, you calculate the amount, so say, let's say you caused them a damage of, say, $345, whatever it is, doesn't make any difference, and you send them the check. You send them the check with a little explanatory note, or even if you just anonymously, you can do it in a way which is doesn't even have your name on it, and now he's got the money back. A person would think that he has, he's fulfilled the requirements. He's redressed the grievance. He's redressed it. He's made compensation. And now he does shuva. What's the answer? The answer is, it's not the truth. You've got to apologize. And it's not even enough to apologize. You have to elicit his mechila. You have to elicit his mechila. And the Rambam talks about that. I mean, it can be a problem sometimes because what if you do all these things and he refuses to be machil? So, if that's the case, the Rambam says you have to go back to him a second time. There's a whole procedure. And the third time, you have to get a group of other people to intercede. The Rambam says, what's the exact thing? I think 10 people or a few people as friends? Is it 10 people? I'm not sure. I don't remember all the specifics right now. Until it's clear that this person is suffering from some type of a serious moral defect, he's an oxar, and then the Rambam says he's the chote because he has a few to forgive after adequate pacification has been made. Then you're absolved, then you can do tshuva. I mean, I've given shiur on this. Oh, you see from this that the main element in tshuva with regard to Bein Adam l'chaveiro is that before you turn to God, you've got to be involved in rectification. And rectification is not measured purely in objective terms, but in terms of the emotional harm that you inflicted upon the person to the point that he is prepared to be machal you. I repeat this, it's a warning to be careful in these areas because you know, people have a tough time controlling themselves. You know, and they get upset with people and they say certain things they don't mean and then they regret. It's difficult enough to apologize sometimes, but you're also putting yourself at somebody else's mercy to a certain extent because, some people are quick to forgive. That's the way you should be. You should be forgiven. But not everybody is that way. And here, the halacha is not based upon the way a person should be ideally. All right, there is a point. If you subject yourself to all the requirements and keep going back and the 10 people and all that, then ultimately you can't be absolved. I mean, bear in mind, you're putting yourself in a bad position. If you're doing something which is going to require the other person's mechila, whereas I'm not advocating that you focus on other sins. I know, I don't mean it that way. I'm just saying in that sense, don't get me the wrong way, obviously, but in that sense, when you sin before God, you don't have that, you see, you're dealing with God and
you don't have an obstacle.
You don't have the obstacle because God, of course, as the God's compassion is of a different kind. So therefore, it's based purely on it must be sincere in our, if we sincerely come before God with genuine tshuva and all of the elements, so we can be guaranteed that God is merciful, God will accept it. Yeah, but that's why David and all said, Niflonah b'yadav Hashem, let me fall into the hands of God, ki rabim rachamav, because his mercies are great, we add Adam Alapola. That's what we say in Tachlin every day. when David had to choose, so to speak, what punishment, whether it should be plague, which is from the hands of God, or whether it be the sword, you know, where he'd be subject to the will of other people, the aggressive tendencies of other people. So he says, Niflin al b'yad Hashem. And let me fall under the hand of God. I'd rather my punishment comes from God. Ki rabim rachamav. V'yad adam al apolo. It's a very, very important thing to remember in life. Very, very important. People have the exact opposite emotion. They're always turning to human, for human sympathy. Human, whenever they get into a jam, they think they're connections of people, you know, they can count on people. Everybody's looking for connections in life. I meet this one, I meet the other one. Al tiftachu
b'nadivim.
Well, no, you can't.
God, take me
anyway. No, you should depend on God, but depend on God. Well, this is extremely important. I gave a share on it this summer. I didn't give it over here. I did give it over a little bit. So I tried to explain the concept of emunah. That you should rely completely on God. But what people mean by relying completely on God means not to operate in accordance with the system that God set up. That's part of your reliance on God. Part of your reliance on God is to operate within His system, and to the extent that you to recognize your place within that system, and to realize that you're lacking the ability to bring about outcomes, and therefore then you have total faith that if you operate in accordance with the will of God, you live in accordance with the rules of the system, and then you're living your life in terms of God's purpose, that you can rely on the Hashkach of Hashem. You see? So in that respect, it's different. So part of the laws of nature is that you deal with people correctly. Because when you're dealing with people correctly, it doesn't mean you should just ignore people. And not even cater to people in any way. But it's different. If a person is operating in an area who wants to succeed in business, so you have to deal with certain people. You have to meet certain politicians. So a wise person, a person who's operating on the principle of a move of faith, he's not going to say, well, I'm just going to do with the business things, which, you know, and the things that you have to do with people, I'm going to ignore. I'm not going to be friendly. I'm not going to make any effort, because that's believing in people. No, that's nonsensical. Because insofar as you deal, but you look at people as just another element in the natural order, and you try to use your intelligence. That is different from the person who has a real faith in people, that he really believes that these people have the control. And because I got that friendship, it's a different emotion sometimes. When you meet certain wealthy people and you feel, this guy, you begin to rely on him, on his protection. This friendship is what's going to take me through life, and so on and so forth. You have that's a trust that you have now. You feel much more confident about life because of that. That's when it interferes with your emunah with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's a totally different attitude. That's a mistaken type of a phenomenon. People glorify and magnify man. It's just another person. You should always be aware of that. When you meet powerful people, wealthy people, there's this magnification that takes place. And the truth is, they are no different than you and I. No different. Practically speaking, they may have some skills, they may have accomplished certain things, whatever, but it's not, in your mind, it's like awe. Once you start to feel that emotion of awe, you're in big trouble. And it's not true. You see, if you study the world enough, you see how these people, most of their downfalls, but if you look into their personal life, you see how messed up. I mean, it's not, maybe they're not messed up, but they're no different. They are just the same as anybody else. They know it. They know it themselves. Some of them are honest about it, and they don't put on airs. They don't, you know, they don't act any differently. Most of them do, because they enjoy that feeling. That in fact, that's the only real incentive for once a person has experienced wealth and he realizes that it's just a fantasy, the only incentive that keeps him going is the enjoyment of the awe of others, the envy of others. It's the envy of others that keeps the wealthy person going. It's the only joy that he really has out of the whole thing. And that's short-lived. We got to a Talmud Chacham, we have a serious attitude of respect. And I can't really describe it and define it right now, and I don't know that I want to use the word awe, you know. This is right off the cuff. I haven't prepared to discuss this right now. But bear in mind that Talmud Chacham also is a human being. You see, so the principle will carry all the way through. He's still a human being. A human being in a perfected state. So therefore, attitude, you see, should be different than someone who's in an imperfected state. Clearly. Clearly. But what happens sometimes is that you find that people relate to the Talmud Chacham with that same emotion, which ordinary people will attribute to what they regard as, you know, what they look up to, successful stars. You see? That is a type of deification. What they're doing is they're simply transferring that emotion to deify certain people, and it could be that it's transferred onto people who do represent the true value, but that's not the appropriate attitude. And you see that, as I said, the greatest of people are just people, because that's what David HaMelech said. Anochi Rima Velo Ish. I'm just a worm. And Avram said Anochi Yafa Ve'efa. So you're going to have to, I mean, you're going to have to come to a decision. I mean, was Avram correct or was he incorrect? He himself said, I'm off of Eifa, then he's basically saying, I mean, certainly not claiming to be more than a man, obviously. He's claiming to be less. He's claiming to be just the off of Eifa. Nothing. Minimal. Not worthy. I mean, you wouldn't have an awe of off of Eifa. Okay, so you'll say, most people say, yeah, that's what Avram had to say about himself, but we, for us, it's something different. But that doesn't make sense to me, because then he was wrong. I mean, if you're going to say that, then he was really wrong. He didn't have the truth. What's the truth? Is the truth off of Afer, or is the truth of something different? It's off of Afer. So, however, we do have an attitude of serious respect for the Talmud Chacham. Darta Pnei Zaken, and so on and so forth, means that we have to assume a certain attitude. And the awe is, of course, with regard to the fact that these people reflect to the greatest extent the source of all greatness, of true greatness, and that's a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You see? That is the basis for that. So I would say, getting back to the point, to the question that Benji raised, my answer would be, as Yoni said, that if the brothers had decided that they really had to do tshuva, then in this case it was a tshuva involving a chet which was ben Adam l'chaver. They therefore would have to do everything possible to rectify the situation. And there were two parties. The essential party they'd sinned against was Yosef. It therefore seems incongruous to me that they would have done nothing at all to search for Yosef and to save him. Because how can you do tshuva? And therefore it was clear that since 22 years had passed and they had not done anything at all, they had not done anything at all to seek him out, that they had not done tshuva.
Maybe they
had they done tshuva, they would have to do tshuva for Yaakov too.
Yaakov,
so then they didn't do tshuva. You can't be afraid. I mean, I don't know if they told Yaakov, so Yaakov was it, let's launch a search. They said they came down for food.
The Afghan Nano is
clear that they're not interested in looking for him. Because
they can't say what they're doing.
Excuse me. You'll say like this. You'll say, but they couldn't tell them that they were looking for our brother, because that would mean they don't have to tell them that we sold our brother. They could have said our brother was kidnapped. They could have come. Listen,
if the brother
like this, I was like this. That you'll ask, but they could not admit to strangers that they had sold their brother. I agree, but in that situation, you'd be permitted to lie, obviously. Let's assume even now that they were going to do tshuva. They didn't have to, in order to undertake a search for Yosef, there was no need to say that they sold him. Nobody knew that. All they had to do was say that he was kidnapped. He was stolen, and we had some information that he was brought down here as a slave. In those days, kidnapping for slavery, etc., it happens today, but certainly in those days that would not have been unusual. He got lost. The story He got lost. He was sent out to meet us one day, and he was lost. And we had some news that he was brought down in a caravan. So I wanted to take a search. Ivri, how many Ivrim are there in the land of Egypt? He's an Ivri. I'm not saying that they definitely would have found him, but clear from Chazal that when they came, that was one of their purposes, was to try and find him. So why wouldn't they have done so earlier? So therefore it was clear to Yosef that at that point in time the brothers had not done tshuva. They had not done tshuva. Yaakov had to prompt them, Lama Tisro. Yeah, Yaakov told them to go down and get food. The whole idea of coming down was initiated by Yaakov. If they were waiting for an opportunity to go down, they would have brought it up. So clearly there was no indication. I'll tell you something else. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with Yosef had a deep insight, a deep, it will come out in the story, a deep understanding of his brothers, and just aside from this, I think this helps us, but aside from this, he went in accordance with his understanding of things. See, today, in today's society, everybody needs a proof. An idea makes sense to the mind, it's never good enough. You have to prove it to me. You need like a physical proof for everything. Okay, I mean, in Chumash too, if we can find those types of proofs, it's certainly beneficial. I would say that Yosef's, I'll try and make it clear as we go through the story, that even if you don't have this information, even if this is not, we didn't have this factor. Because let's assume, for example, that they had no way of knowing he was a Mitzrayim, so you could remove my, as if somebody tried to remove my ancestors, and then that wouldn't be a proof anymore. Even so, Yosef would have gone ahead with the same plan. Yosef knew that they hadn't done Jew, because he knew the nature of the chait. He knew from the very nature of the chait and from the behavior of the brothers at the moment of the chait, as will become clear in the story, that they really hadn't done Jew. But there was no way they could have done Jew. I will try and answer that question on a different level, because I'm not satisfied with just a practical. Because the practical one is always open to objection. I mean, that's for the world, it's not. They like the practical. I mean, the theoretical, they hold it open to objection. But we live in the world of ideas. And the theoretical is firm. Okay? Bashir, the first major question we raised was, what is the necessity for all of the dialogue? Basically, what emerges is that Yosef is accusing them unjustly of being spies, and they're defending themselves, which we need to know, and everything seems to revolve around their claim that they're brothers and that they've left one brother behind. So Yosef sets up a test in which the demand is that the only way he can ascertain whether they're speaking the truth is if they bring down this younger brother. That's basically all we need to know. But the Torah, it seems to me that the Torah is going into excessive dialogue, and there's something about the character of the dialogue that needs to be explained. It's that when they try to explain their position, Yosef simply says no. He doesn't even explain what's wrong with it. He doesn't ask them, there's no breakdown. It's just, no. That's what I said, you're spies. So it has that type of character of just being, you know, a situation where no one's listening. People are it's just like a fight, like an argument, and nobody's even listening to what the other side is saying. No one's even bothering. Well, the brothers are. You see, the brothers are attempting to address themselves. They're trying to explain. That's why they say that we're all brothers. Then they go even further. In the second explanation, they go a little bit further and explain and say that there were two other brothers, and one is missing and one is home. And that's where Yosef seizes upon the idea to bring one down. On the other side, you have a situation where one side is sort of pleading their case, and Yosef is not refuting it, it's just that he's not listening, he's unwilling to listen. He's just throwing it right back in their face, as though what they're saying has no value at all. The focus of the Shia really is after the brothers are released from jail. Because Yosef modifies his plan. At first he locks them all up in jail, and he tells them that the only way you'll be able to extricate yourself from this is by sending one brother back. I'll keep you all here. Send one brother back to bring the younger brother to me. He, so he locks them up for 3 days. Then after the third day, he modifies his position. He becomes slightly more compassionate, if that's the correct word. It becomes a little bit easier. And he says that there's another alternative. Same objective. You have to bring down your younger brother, but I've changed my mind. I'm not going to be as harsh. And that is to say, I'll leave you all go, but you have to leave one hostage behind. Of course, you can ask yourself the question, why do you have to leave one hostage behind? That's a good question. The plan is to bring down the younger brother, and only through the younger brother will I ascertain whether you're telling the truth. And only if it turns out that you are telling the truth will I provide you with food. So why is it necessary to leave one brother behind? Take that little girl. In other words, now they face the situation that they can't return unless they bring the brother. What difference would it make? Unless you say that now they're forced to return in order to redeem the brother that they left behind. But what's the point? Why would Yosef care about that? In other words, he doesn't want them back, really. If they're spies, he doesn't want them back. So why didn't you say, all you guys go, all you go, now I know who you are, we've got your identity, and so forth. If you try to get back in here again, if you didn't bring down your younger brother, you can't come. Why is it necessary? It has to make sense, by the way. You can't just, you know. He has to appear to them as having some kind of a plan that makes sense to them. So, because why didn't they? They could have said, well, if you're letting us go, let us go with. They could have answered them. They could have said, well, let us go with this brother. Why are you locking him up? Because he's a spy, so let him go. If we come back again, why did they make the appeal, please let us take our brother home? And if we have to come back again, we'll bring our younger brother and you'll ascertain the story. What do you need to keep our younger brother behind? Or not our younger brother, it happens to be Shimon. He doesn't want to kill them. He's not suggesting that I'm going to kill you. He's just saying I'm not going to give you food. You're spies. So it seems to me when he says, this shall you do and live, meaning you're not going to get clearance to enter into this country and to start buying food and so forth unless you prove to me that you're not spies.
Well, why can't you just say
about the dangers that they represent right now, so then the first plan makes more sense. So you keep them all locked up and let one guy go. Because the one is insignificant. It's the group. You got the cell, the spy cell. You got that. Why give that up? Doesn't make sense. If you've caught a group of terrorists, you suspect that they're terrorists, and they claim that they're not, so you're going to lock them all up, detain all of them, maybe let one guy go to bring the proof. Because one guy alone is not so bad, but the group. So that's the first plan would make more sense. But to say, you're not going to let all of the suspected terrorists go and just keep one behind, that doesn't make any sense. So therefore you must assume that he wasn't afraid of them. It's just that he's not going to give them access into the country. He's not going to let you in. You can't go freely in the country and do what you'd like to do. You're going to go, but basically, when he accused them of being spies, I don't think he was about to execute them. It certainly doesn't make sense, because if that's the case, then why is he going to let them go home? If they truly are spies, they're not going to come back. Right? So then, what does he gain? He's letting spies go. The answer is that it's part of the idea, v'yamnu divrechem, that the way he played it, I believe, is that since he accuses them of being spies, he will not allow them free access to the country, because they can get information about the vulnerability of the country. Therefore, the test is, this is the test. If you're all one family, then it doesn't make sense that you're spies.
You have to account for the fact that you're coming down together as a group, the way you've been operating over here. Chazal say they came in from different openings and they got together, whatever the case may be. Whatever the case may be, everything hinges upon their story. So now you've got to prove to me that your story is true, that you're simple people and you're all members of one family, so then you're not spies. Now, how is the bringing down this other brother? Bear in mind that they don't know they're dealing with Yosef. So that's what Yosef is doing has to make sense to them. So that's not much of a test. They can go back home and they can get anybody. You pay somebody to come down and pretend that it's the brother. That's not so difficult. You can't determine. How do you get to know? You can't determine by looks. You get someone that looks reasonably like the rest of them, with a beard, whatever the case may be, and he's the brother. There's no way you don't know. Since Yosef, that's an important factual question. Since Yosef doesn't know this brother, ostensibly doesn't know, right? Because they don't know it's Yosef. So why, you know, they could bring, and Yosef's objective is to have Binyamin come down. But why didn't Yosef can take this into consideration? That to get around his requirements, all they needed to do was to pay somebody who they trusted, who knew, give him all the information he needs to know, and come down and say, that's my brother. And that would have met the test. And Yosef, of course, would have failed, because Yosef's true objective was to get Binyamin down there. How did Yosef know that when they came down, they would only come back again with the brother, with Binyamin? How can you be assured of that? Why, wouldn't you think that these people are intelligent? Yosef, they're intelligent people. They're not going to expose their brother to this risk. Why not get a stranger and pay the guy money? That what he meant was he would keep one brother behind and interrogate him and ask for all kinds of information. So then Yosef has the advantage, because there are certain things in any family. If you're going to write the history of a family, I mean, it depends how detailed you want to get. If you want to really get detailed, there's virtually unlimited amount of information, right? That just you could write about 1 year in the life of your family. Details, you know. So there's just virtually unlimited. And so there are certain types of big things, small things, and so on and so forth. Now, they knew that they're dealing with a very tough cookie, so to speak. This Yosef is very tough. What it meant was that he now had complete access to interrogate Shimon. And they don't know. How can they know what kinds of questions he's asking? What kinds of information he's going to be giving over? So there are certain things that only someone who was actually part of the family would know. And brothers, even children wouldn't know. Going back to certain events in your life, when he was born, what happened on that day? This, you know, all kinds of, they don't know what he's asking. So there's no way that whoever they would choose, they would have to pry the person. Because Yosef is not just going to believe that he's the brother, he's going to question you. That's the Reichem. We'll test your words. That means you're going to bring this person down, I'm going to interrogate him, and I'm going to see if it's a match. How am I going to know it's a match? Because I'm going to hold one brother behind, and I'm going to interrogate him. And you know, you have no way of knowing what questions I'm going to ask him. So therefore, you have no choice. You're going to be taking a crazy risk if you bring down somebody that doesn't have access to the same information. Like two brothers that grew up together, and I can interrogate one, and I could ask him. I could ask him all kinds of questions. You might tell me. I could ask you something happened on the day of your bar mitzvah at the party. Some event occurred, something strange. I'll say, well, was your brother there? Was your brother know about it? And you say, yes. Well, you say, no. I mean, there's all kinds of... But I already have a tremendous data bank, so to speak. Now, when this other person comes down, if he doesn't know these things, it's not a match. This was DNA before it was invented. There's no way to duplicate it. And if you're intelligent, you can't take that risk. That's why there was never a holiday, as the brother said. You see, Yaakov was very reluctant to release Binyamin, but no one ever came up with the suggestion, well, let's get somebody else. Because they knew that was crazy. The main focus of this year is on the reaction of the brothers. which is stated in Pasuk Aleph and in Pasuk Bet. Let's go through the Pesukim. So now, after the, you know, they've been released and Yosef has given them the terms, so it says, "Vayomru ish alachiv," each one said to the other, "Aval ashemim anachnu alachinu," indeed, or however, "we are guilty with regard to our brother. In that we saw the suffering of his soul when he pleaded with us and we didn't listen. Therefore has come upon us this great suffering." Okay? That's Pasuk 1. Then the next Pasuk is Vayan Reuven Osam, and Reuven responded to them saying, "Did I not say to you, do not sin against the lad, and you didn't listen? And also his blood is now being avenged." Now I maintain that if we analyze it carefully, each one of those psukim contains problems. And you have to subject the psukim to an analysis pretty much like we analyze the Gemara. Same way. That's the way I treat the Chumash. It might be unique, I mean I think it is, because I don't see it too often, is that we bring the same, pretty much the same type of an approach. It can't be identical because you're dealing with halachic phenomena. So in that respect it's going to be different, but in terms of the analysis, the approach, to treat the Chumash, breaking it down into the constituent elements, raising the questions, the contradictions, the difficulties, analyzing it as though it's a piece of Gemara. That is, I suppose, what's unique about our method in Chumash. The major problem is something which, again, when the average person reads it, it sounds intelligible, makes sense to him, because it fits in with his own emotional understanding of things. Oh yeah, you see, the brothers saw that they were being punished, bad things happened, that's it, it shows that you're wrong. That is how the average person would read it, but if you analyze it, first of all, is this the correct philosophy? We assume that they're operating with the correct philosophy. Now, as I said, when the brothers decided to sell Yosef, it was the basis of a deliberation. It was a decision. It wasn't just an emotion of the moment. And they, in their own minds, believed that they were doing the correct thing. Now, sometimes a person makes a mistake, but it seems from everything we read that nothing happened to cause them to change their mind. Even the thing you would imagine that would get them to rethink it would have been the extent of the suffering of Yaakov. Because it says that it's clear that they were surprised by the extent, because they tried to comfort him and he refused to be comforted. And he said, "I'll go down to my grave mourning." But you didn't say it, but the brothers didn't say, "Well, therefore we're guilty." Why didn't they say, "Therefore we're guilty"? Because the fact that he's suffering, they may not have anticipated it, but that doesn't change the decision. Decision is decision. Person decides to give the death penalty. Close call, but he uses his best judgment. And he makes a decision, and then he sees the enormity of the extent of the anguish of the relatives. So if that caused him to change his mind, so then you question his judgment. Well, what is that doing? Unless new information has come to light. Then you say that this person is someone who can't stick to a decision. He's emotional. He may be sorry. He may be sorry about it, but if the decision is reached on logical ground, so that's basically, you have to stick with it. It seems that the brothers stuck with it. They didn't, because they did not have, there's an indication, Chazal, that then by Yered Yehuda Meisechav, it affected them. It did cause a certain dissension in the family. But it doesn't say, it's clear they didn't do tshuva, they didn't say that we're guilty. And we proved that last week. We said that they had not done tshuva. We tried to bring certain proofs. That they had not done tshuva. There was no indication that they had done a tshuva. And Yosef, we said, Yosef was quite sure that they hadn't done tshuva. Alright, now we're saying, if they had done tshuva, then they would have tried to get in touch with him to try and see if they could save him. But also, I guess he understood their state of mind. He was there when it happened, and he saw that they were... He knew their nature. He was dealing with great men, and great men can make mistakes, but when they do so, it's based upon what they consider to be right. And once they reach a decision, that's it for them. They're not so quick to change. Unless new information comes into the picture. The case, what does one thing have to do with the other? Here we're talking about a period of 22 years. Okay, according to most reckonings, it's 22 years since the event occurred. And during all of that time, you know, they had an opportunity to rethink. They may have rethought it. I would assume that they would have rethought it. They hadn't changed. So what is the connection between what's happening now? I mean, is that the way we're supposed to live our lives? That if a person makes a decision, and it's a tough call, close call, and he uses his best judgment, or a posek, like Rav Moshe says, even a posek doesn't know that what he's saying is the objective truth, but it's a halachic truth, if a person has the knowledge, he knows how to learn, he's a master of the area, he goes to the sources, uses his utmost effort and diligence and so forth, and he comes to a decision, so he has the right to poskin. Could be that he made a mistake. I don't think, but the litmus test would not be that a week later, you know, or 2 weeks later, or 22 years later, if something bad happens in his life, that proves that stock was wrong. You can't live your life that way. It doesn't make sense. I mean, things are happening all the time that we're going to have to undo. Where do you get such a notion from? I know people have a certain superstitious attitude, which, you know, when they do certain things, and then they sort of wait. And if something happens to them, yeah, that's it. That shows that was wrong. If something good happens to them, then they feel more confident. A lot of times when you do things that you're not too proud of, you know, you're kind of a little upset about yourself if you do them. So you're sort of like waiting a certain amount of time. There's sort of a testing time. But usually about a week or two. You feel a little bit nervous. And something bad happens during that time, aha! The car breaks down, you get stuck on the road, aha, I'm getting punished already. On the other hand, if you get through that period of time and nothing good happens, you start to feel a little better. Beat the rat. I mean, but that's like a childish way of looking at things. It's kind of childish. But here, we're talking about a situation where the brothers didn't even think that what they had done was wrong. They thought that they were doing the right thing. If you assume that they're tzaddikim. And it's 22 years later, and what's one thing got to do with the other? The truth of the matter is, even if a calamity occurs, it doesn't prove that it's connected to that, but this was, you know, this was not the worst thing in the world, it wasn't a good thing, it was sort of like, you know, how would you describe what occurred to them? It wasn't a catastrophe. Yeah, it was a setback, it was a problem, let's put it this way, they had a problem on their hands. But it, you know, from all appearances, it's something you could deal with. And they came back to Yaakov, and they were telling him that, you know, we can deal with it, we can handle it. It's just it's more than an inconvenience. Obviously, it's serious when a brother is held behind and in jail, and you have to bring him. You know, I mean, it's a complication. I'd say it's a serious problem. But these things happen in life. And just anytime something goes wrong in your life. You mean automatically that proves? What is it prove? That's also difficult. Because it says, and Reuven, well, Vayan literally is the answer. It's a little bit difficult because it doesn't seem like there's any kind of a question there. But in the sense that he sort of responded to them. What's difficult about what Reuven's statement? Yes? Yeah, there's two things that are wrong with it. If you take a look at the story itself, go back to the story itself, here's a very interesting story, a case. Because here we have it's sort of like you have the tape. You have the event itself, and then you have how someone is retelling it 22 years later. Well, you can go back to this, so to speak, to the tape. Go back to the story, and you will see that Reuven did not say this in the story. All Reuven said was, don't kill him outright, put him into the pit. And he said that, because he was using deceit. His purpose was to really save Yosef, but he couldn't tell it to the brothers. Then he convinced them that it's better to put him in the pit, not to execute him with your own hand. And put him in the pit. And the Torah tells us that it was Laman Hatzel also, in order to really save him. But in terms of telling the brothers, what he told them was that it's okay to dispose of him, but we dispose him this way, not that way. Not, but he doesn't record that he said this, do not sin against the lad, but lo shematem. That's one problem. Okay? The other problem, though, is, I think, as Mark is saying, that what's his point? It sounds like a immature type of thing to say. Like, I told you not to do it. What's the gain? What's the benefit? Right? It's the kind of thing that you find annoying. You know, first of all, you're part of the whole conspiracy yourself. You're involved. You can't be trying to disassociate yourself. Yeah. And you're trying to give us mussar. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the point? We just admitted we're wrong. We just admitted we're wrong. So what are you gaining now? What are you adding by telling us I told you not to do it? What are you gaining by that? So that statement is also difficult. No, it didn't mean. Don means you destroyed him. He used a harsh term. Of course, the plan of selling him into slavery wasn't that much better than killing him. It was basically to destroy him by other means. The only advantage it had was that he was still alive. So, where there's life, you can argue. Where there's life, there's some type of hope. But their point was that we can get rid of this problem without having to be murderers. But Rabbi Reuven is saying in the rebuke is that v'gam damo, because that's in terms of reality, you destroyed the guy. So to destroy a person means his blood is being avenged. Even though he's physically alive, you destroyed him. You destroyed his life. That's what Reuven was telling him. You destroyed his life. Of course, they knew that. They knew when they sold him into slavery that, you know, it wasn't a pleasant thing, it wasn't a positive thing. They knew. They accepted Yehuda's plan that Lord Hashem, let's not be murderers. We'll lessen the extent of the crime. Of course, they didn't believe it was a crime. All right, so we can analyze that. Why they went through these steps, from actual killing to putting him in the pit to selling him. What was their logic? If they thought he's guilty, why did they execute him? I went through that already in Shiurim. I'm not taking that up right now. That's not the issue. Okay? But the issue is, what's the point of Reuven? What's he trying to do here? What's the purpose of the statement? You've got to read what they said very carefully. If you read the pasuk very carefully, you'll see that they did not admit that what they did was wrong. Only on one thing. Asherino Tsaras Nafsho, that we witnessed the suffering of a soul when he pleaded with us and we did not listen. First of all, a problem that arises is that we could ask the same question if we roll back the tape. Where do you see that Yosef pleaded with them and they didn't listen? The story does not record it. In the narrative section, that Yosef pleaded with the brothers. So that's a problem that's taken up by the Mefarshim, essentially the Ramban. And he gives a few different reasons why the Torah did not record it. And they all make sense, but I'll tell you the one that I prefer. He says that, first of all, he says that that's the style of the Torah. That the words of the Torah are, you know, rich, so to speak, in one place and poor in other places. In other words, that the Torah doesn't mention everything at that time, because when God wrote that section, obviously God knew he was going to write the retelling, and all that piece of information will be included later. So you have to use that and put it all together. Or else he says that says that it's not necessary because it's something that everybody knows. It's something you can take for granted, obviously. That when a brother is being subjected to this kind of treatment, maybe he's going to plead for mercy, so the Torah didn't have to record it. So it's not a gap. The Torah didn't record it. Then you can assume it. Now, Reuven, it's only of importance to us. It wouldn't be of importance to mention it. It's only of importance to us now because the brothers, rather, are confessing their guilt with regard to that element. Okay. My own explanation as to why the Torah would specifically decide to leave that out as a narrative and only bring it in the retelling. According to the Ramban makes this point that they were confessing to one thing and one thing only, the lack of Rahman. And that is to say that in Dine Nefashos, when you even judges, when you deal with a matter of life and death, you have to approach it with an attitude of Rahman. That's the halacha. It's incorporated into the halacha. That there are certain mechanisms built in to make it more difficult to convict. There has to be a certain underlying motive. The motivation has to be one of compassion, but of course you can't judge by your emotion. The judgment has to be a judgment. Certain people who are excluded from the Sanhedrin, a person that has no children, or a person that's like an ox, a very tough kind of a person, even though he's a great Talmud Chacham. Because it's a recognition of the fact that emotions do play a role. But not the way, not the way you're accustomed to, not like you try and influence the emotions of the judge. A true posek, someone who's on the Sanhedrin, must decide, he must put emotions aside. I mean, if he feels compassion, but he's totally convinced that this person's chayav misa, he can't go by the emotion. That's us. Okay? But so if that's the case, then why do we care if a person is compassionate? A person that has children, a person that has children is more reluctant to execute someone. He knows Sargidal Bottom, he has a certain sympathy he brings to the situation. Someone that never had children can't be involved in capital cases. But why? You don't want emotions, you want justice. The answer is that it's true that the judgment has to be based upon justice. Yeah, but the more a person is inclined to search, the more that you're increasing the possibility that he may find the genuine trust. Like two people are searching for a cure. So if the cure has to be, you can't make up a cure on your emotions, it's got to be real. But the individual, one person, they're both equally... Yeah, exactly. They both have the same scientific expertise. One guy has a disease, he's going to be working day and night, every possibility, I mean, he won't close down any possibility. The other person is going to do a professional job, but there's limits. Yeah. So therefore, that's the idea. That in case there is somewhere out there, and it's not that evident, some basis of schus, it's more likely that the one who has that emotional impetus to find that the emotion does affect the person, to look in a certain direction. See? So what they were saying was that they're not recanting. The decision we made was the correct one. However we went about it, we showed no rachmanis when he was pleading with us and we refused to listen. We did not allow ourselves to be influenced. That's a chait. The chait, because you're supposed to be a marachin, you're supposed to have rachmanis, you're supposed to listen. But we refused to open up our minds to give him a chance to plead his case. Now, then I say, maybe we'll listen, we'll give it a chance, we would have come to the same conclusion. Maybe not. I mean, at this point, they're not, we don't know what would have happened. So therefore, they didn't say that we were wrong. But they realize now, for the first time, they're willing to acknowledge that the way in which they went about it was very sinful because they were lacking in compassion. Now, if that's the case, you understand what Yosef was doing. Yosef knew how the brothers would interpret events. In other words, he knew that they acknowledged the existence of the Ashkacha. And therefore, you learn out certain things about the Ashkacha. You sort of have how to read the Ashkacha. You have to learn how to read the Ashkacha to whatever extent you can. I mean, it's a very difficult area. But there are certain principles that we can go by. One of the principles that we can go by, I think, has been mentioned, and that is that when things occur, see, a person has a tendency to view himself as being the center of everything. Now, sometimes things occur. I mean, there's hurricanes and so forth to wipe out a whole, it can affect the whole area. So if it affects a whole area, thousands and thousands of people and property and that and this and that, then a person will say, it's all because of me. Because I did that, proves that. You know, how do you know? How do you know? First of all, it's part of, these things happen every so often, every, you know. not something that's that unusual, not outside the realm of nature, and it didn't happen specifically to you. So that possibility exists. By the way, a person should do tshuva when negative things happen anyway, any type of setback. It's a different concept. Because as a result of this, he can look into himself and see that there's something wrong in his philosophy. But that doesn't mean to say that this event is geared to send a message to you specifically. You see? Now, I would say that there are certain factors involved. First of all, if the thing is very unusual, see, the more the thing that's happening is within the realm of the natural, the less reason there is to say that it's specifically for you. You follow? I mean, cars get flat tires. It's not, you know, you're driving a car for like 35,000 miles and you get a flat tire in the middle of the road. It doesn't have to be like, you know, these things happen. I mean, with laws of nature, after a certain amount of wear and tear, there's a bump. There's bumps in the road. I mean, that's not unusual, especially in New York. There's bumps all over the place. So if it happens, I mean, yeah, again, it's possible that it's a personal thing. It's also possible that it's just, that's it. Chance, laws of chance. And maybe if you're on a higher level, so the Hashgacha could have intervened to save you from that. But it doesn't mean that there's a specific message in it for you. It doesn't have to be that way. So one of the factors I would think would be that the thing that happened is pretty yosei min haklal. Doesn't prove it because things happen yosei min haklal, but that's already something to cause you to think, like, why did this happen to me? This doesn't happen. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, and this is something which I heard over in the name of Rabbi Chase said, that another barometer, if you've gone through certain things which are unusual and are bothering you, and you're curious as to whether it has anything to do with you, you should look back. Look back in your life and see whether this has any, you know, you can see clearly a relationship between this and what you did wrong. If it has any connection, you see? Now, it seems to me that what Yosef was doing, because Yosef knew the mentality of the brothers, he deliberately set up a situation which would cause them to come to the conclusion that this wasn't happening to him. That's why they say, "Our king ba'aleinu atzara hazot." How can they say? How do you know? They saw that this was something unusual, because obviously they observed the situation that this wasn't happening to anybody. In other words, he had a very smooth operation. This you have to deduce. He had a very smooth operation going, and he wasn't subjecting it. If everybody was being subjected to this type of treatment and scrutiny and being locked up and demanding, then why would you think an unusual one told? Right? If you go through, you know, you want to get into Mexico at the border, and everybody has to go through the same procedure. So you have to go through the procedure, so you're not going to start thinking about it. That's the norm. It wasn't set up for you. But therefore, you must conclude that they were being treated completely differently. Okay, so that's one, that gives you, alright, so now let's look into it. The second element, now you'll understand why there's so much dialogue, is that Vayadaber Itam Kushas. He chose, they put themselves in the same situation that they were completely innocent, and they were being falsely accused, but worse than that, no one was listening to them. And whatever they said, they pleaded with him. They were pleading with him in the same way that Yosef was pleading with them. And here, this person wasn't even listening to them. Totally closed, no mercy. That's the thing that got them the most. And that's why they looked back in their lives and they started to search. That's why it's interesting. If you take a look at the pasuk, it says, Avol, Avol Hashem Anachnu. Now I always raise the question, because Avol means however. Or it means indeed. But you cannot begin a sentence, or you can't begin a composition with the word Avol. Right? Am I correct? It's impossible. Because the term Avol always presupposes something else. It comes to modify something that's been stated before Avol. There must have been something else. Then you say, we're going to be doing such and such and such and such. Avol, however, you see, you can't start off with avol. Try and do it, it doesn't work. Therefore, in my opinion, it triggered off a process. They began to review their lives to see whether there's something specific that they could relate it to. And I'd say, since they were tzaddikim, they went to different areas. They didn't just jump to this conclusion. But then they came back to the mechira, and they said, there's one thing I've all. Now they saw it differently. Hashem manachnu alachinu. See, they had buried that before. They hadn't thought about that before. Why? Because since they were convinced that there was correct to sell them, so they didn't bother about that. But then they realized it triggered something off. That the way they were being treated was too eerily, of course, Yosef knew the nuances. He was there, so he knew exactly how to make it seem. You know, sometimes something happens and it's sort of uncanny. It's not just that it's the same general thing, but it's happening very specifically. So Yosef knew how to pull it off so that it would get to them, and that's exactly this. Hey, we're reliving something. Deja vu. We're sort of reliving something. Except now we're... This is exactly the way we were acting. Hashem v'anachnu. Then Al-Kain Ba'alein Matzarazot. This is not an accident. This is too much in line exactly with the way we were behaving. Thank you. Al-Kain Ba'alein Matzarazot. This Torah. In other words, just the mere fact that a person goes through a tough time, every time a person goes through a tough time in life, he doesn't confess guilt. But they saw in this tzara is very unusual. It's a yotem and a klal, and in a way which goes exactly to the heart of what we did wrong. And that can't be patient. And therefore, Hashem v'anah, they recognize their guilt. Of course, the next question is, what's Reuven? Yosef, that's why there's so much dialogue. Yosef, whatever they said, Yosef says, low. That's what I said. You're wrong. You're a ragwan. In other words, he's not makabel their words.
He's not being merciful.
Exactly. He wasn't makabel their words. That's exactly what they did to him. They weren't makabel. That's what the Midrash said. If they eschan no eilenu, he's pleading with us for love shamanu. We wouldn't listen. So Yosef didn't listen to them. It's clear he didn't listen to them. He says, no. Miragma matem. Why did you listen? They were being treated exactly as they had treated. Now you could see that this type of thing is wrong. Now, Chacham, that's exactly, by the way, what Nosan Hanavi did to David HaMelech. He depicted a similar situation. He goes through that story, it's beautiful. After David had sinned with Bathsheba, had taken Bathsheba. Then he had sent Uriah, arranged to have him killed in the front. So Nasan depicted a similar situation indirectly about this wealthy man who lived next to a poor guy, and the poor guy had nothing except one little sheep that grew up with the family and ate from the same bread and so on and so forth. That's all they had. That was their whole life. And this wealthy guy had tons and tons of objects and animals and so forth. And then suddenly a guest arrived at the wealthy man's house, and he didn't have the willingness to use one of his own animals. So he came and he stole the sheep of this poor little guy. So David HaMelech said, Ben Malasu. He said, he's a Rashi, he deserves to be killed. Such an Achzarius. And of course, that was a reference to what he had done. He was the wealthy guy. He had all these, he had everything, he had all these wives. And if it's not enough, I'll give you more wives. And you had everything. And this poor man, all he had was this was his life. And you took it away and you sent him to the front. You killed him. So David HaMelech Rekhi Chatasi. It's in a similar vein. He's doing the same thing over here. They're seeing now, you say, if you're smart, sometimes you can't see it in yourself because you always treat yourself much better. But you can see it in somebody else. If you see somebody else behaving in a cruel kind of a fashion, in a mean kind of a fashion, you have a certain attitude. But then, if you're a smart person, you look back and you'll find that maybe you behave that way. If people just take the first step. Oh, that person is disgusting. What disgusting behavior. And they disassociate themselves. Like, well, one second. Let's go further. Did you ever do things like that? That they don't want to think about. People are extremely incisive, and people are extremely critical, judgmental about evil behavior, as long as it can be seen in somebody else. But then the jump, you can learn life, you can learn from every experience you go through. Whenever you see somebody acting in a mean way, in a greedy way, in a sympathetic way, then you think back to you, is that me out there? Do I do something? Is there any time I acted like that? You'll find something. But you never looked at it that way before, because it was you who was doing it. And when you do it, there's 25 excuses. But when the other person does it, there's no excuses, you see? So a person can learn a great deal from observing other people when they're doing the wrong thing. But only if you take the second step. If you take the first step, that person's a Russian. Yeah. That's what David did. That's a Russian. But then Nelson said, well, now let's shift it and let's see whether there's anything in your life that's exactly the same as that. And that you can learn from. As far as Reuven is concerned, again, we had the same question, but it doesn't seem from the story that Reuven said these things to them. But however, you have to realize one thing. This proves that before they actually came to the conclusion to kill Yosef and to sell him, they went through a process of deliberation. This proves it. They didn't just act on the spur of the moment. There was a process of that abasement, so to speak. Deliberation. In the process of deliberation, it's clear that there was a defense. And the defender of Yosef was Reuven. Reuven argued his case. That's clear. It doesn't become clear until now. And it even becomes clear what the defense was. This pasuk is going to tell you what the defense was. Now, it is true that Reuven was the one who said, let's put him in the pit, which seems to indicate that he agreed with the general idea, just was, giving a different way of killing him. But that means to say that in the trial process, Reuven defended him and argued against killing him, but once the brothers decided to kill him, he had to go along with them. Because the only way he could save him was to go along with them. You see? If they knew that he was opposed and he wasn't going to go along with it, then they would not have listened to his suggestion. It would have been suspicious. So therefore he accepted the judgment, and then he only said, but let's not kill him directly, let's put him in the pit. But he was the defender. Now, all along Reuven was convinced that they had done the wrong thing. He wanted to save him. Of course Chazal says that the main reason was because he couldn't face his father, he felt responsible. Whatever the case may be, that's a different issue. But he was convinced that it was wrong. And he argued that way. So therefore, but he couldn't do anything about it. All these years, he was waiting for the opportunity to rebuke them, to get them to do tshuva. But the moment had not arrived. Now he saw that the moment had arrived, because the barrier to their tshuva, in point of fact, the factor which was responsible for them arriving at this decision was not purely intellectual, because they approached it with a lack of rachmanis. They had lost their rachmanis, and the Rashi says, "Hesiu atzman min ha'achva." They had totally disassociated themselves from brotherhood. And once that occurred, in their own minds, everything was purely logical, but it wasn't. It's because they had absolutely no sympathy for him, which was manifested in that they wouldn't listen. That's why they arrived. Now, as long as they had that attitude toward Yosef, that Yosef was not deserving of our sympathy, there was no way that Reuven could get them to look at the decision again, to revisit the decision. Now Reuven saw his opening. Because at this point in time, they had not done Teshuvah Gemurah. Teshuvah Gemurah meant to recognize the chait. It was more than just that. That was the cause, but the effect was that you came to a serious chait. The decision itself, the mechir itself, was a serious chait. So that's when he said, now that they were willing to admit that they lacked rachmanis, they would be willing, had they been viewing the situation from the perspective of Rachmanis, they would have viewed it differently. Now he pointed out, I told you, Al Techtu Vayeled, below Shemata. Now Al Techtu Vayeled is more than just describing what he said. It's actually the Ramban says that this exactly was the nature of his defense. Reuven's defense was, he's a yeller. And that all the factors you're pointing out against him, which you're saying that's his essence, and you're defining him as being inherently ra, and must be destroyed? No! It's just a manifestation of the fact that he's a youth. It's craziness. That's true. He's not going to argue about his vanity. Not going to argue about his debas ra. Not going to argue about his dreams. But that's not the essence. You have no right to come to a conclusion because that's a result of his youthfulness. And you, a lot of teachers have to, parents have to be aware of that. You see, many, many times. I've seen it many times. That you can't, you don't know a person when he's young. Because when a person is young, he's under the sway of powerful emotion. And then, you know, his seichel, his reasoning power is not that powerful. And you see a lot of the people that were the wildest kids in school and rebellious and so on, so they can go on and then you see them 10, 15 years later. You can't believe it. They're one of the most successful pillar of the community. What happened? Because you made a mistake. But you have to take into consideration. There is a case of a Ben Sora Morev, where the Torah prescribed that he has to be destroyed, even though it's Lohayla and Hibra, never actually occurred. You know, but that's different. But here, it's not for us to decide. I told you, you're making a mistake. If you were willing to look at the situation more closely, you would have seen that it's a Yelet. He has good qualities. But he's acting crazily because of youthful craziness. Velo Shematem, you wouldn't listen. Now you want the tshuva. That's what you got to listen. That's what you got to think about. The Gamdamo Hine Nidrash. And as a result of this, you have to take into consideration all the consequences. All the consequences. You have a serious situation to deal with. You're guilty. You're guilty of unjustified murder. It's actually murder. That's what you have to confront. You want the tshuva, you have to have a karas achet. A karas achet has to be complete. It means, insofar as this is clear that this is related to the chait, so then be prepared. You're not just being punished for a lack of rechut. It's much more than that. It's gam dama hinei nidrash. No, because according to them, it's not a gam dama hinei nidrash. According to them, it's simply the lack of rachmanis, which is one level. So that's not failing to display rachmanis is serious, but not as bad as actually destroying someone. So they wanted to maintain, we were guilty of a lack of rachmanis, but we're not guilty of murder, of dama nidrash. He's saying, no. It's very important because this is the moment of tshuva. If you're going to do tshuva, you have to have a total akaras achet. And the real chet is not just a chet of a lack of rachmanis. It's a chet of al tekstu vayelet. That affected your entire judgment. Don't try and avoid that. People will admit, it's very hard for a person to, the ultimate akaras achet, the ultimate confession is that you were wrong. That's the hardest thing to get a person to admit, that he was wrong. The hardest thing, especially Chacham. Because Chacham, they have a lot of confidence in their mind. But to get them to admit they were wrong is very difficult. People, it's true, maybe I was a little rough, maybe I was a little hot, but what I did, essentially, I was right in my judgment. You see that. A lot of times you complain, sorry, or a professor, or a rabbi, whatever the case is. And sometimes the person will admit, all right, it's true. Maybe I should have listened a little more. Maybe I was abrupt. I was impatient with you. Basically, my judgment is correct. You get a person to say that his judgment was false. That's the real chatas. Very few people ever admit that they're wrong. Very few people, I find. Very few people. It's very, very hard, even among somebody that's wrong. World in politics, politicians, where they'll never ever get up and say that they were completely wrong. Even if they're caught, they'll defend themselves, they'll rationalize. And you see, even amongst some of them, there's a debate, a difference of opinion, even over halacha. Very rare. One side takes a position, and the other side will break it down, show you with proof. How many people will come back and say, yes, you're right. You proved it, I'm wrong, I made a mistake. That is the hardest thing for a person to admit that he made a mistake. People don't like to admit that anything that he did is wrong. People don't like to admit that they're cold, that they were insensitive, that they weren't compassionate. But that is easier to admit, somehow or other. Because that's an emotion. But people can't stand the